We resume our study of Locke. We have covered in brief his theory of ethics. I know we'll do his transition to ontology. We've spent a lot of time with his epistemology, because that's what he did. But he does transition to a theory of reality. And to put it briefly, Locke thinks there are three kinds of things we can know for sure the existence of. Those are selves. I can know the existence of myself. That's an intuitive kind of knowledge, he says. Of course, he means that we can introspect and catch ourselves thinking this, doing that, abstracting this, maybe calculating something mathematically or doing a logical inference. But we can be aware of ourselves in the operations of our mind. Of course, he assumed that right from the outset, didn't he? Because he thought that the way to do philosophy was to describe what the mind does when it thinks, when it perceives, thinks, wills, and so on, that the way to do philosophy was to start with the operations of the mind. What is in the mind? What does the mind deal with? And he's still right there, isn't he? Everything that we know, he says, is in the mind. Everything we know is either a perception or a concept, some such thing as that. And he calls them all collectively ideas. That term idea just means something that exists in our minds. And now we have these three ideas, and he thinks that we can indeed know that these three correspond to really existing things outside our mind. So I've summarized this for you with this little chart. All we know is inside our minds, that's percepts and concepts, which he calls collectively ideas. But we know the real existence, which means external to the mind, real existence of three kinds of things: selves, bodies, and God. These are the same three that Descartes argued for. And Locke claims that we know selves by intuitively, by introspection. We know bodies in the world outside minds by perception. And of course, we've already seen that that should be, in his epistemology, a great big problem. If perceptions are just things that happen inside minds, maybe they're little copies of what's outside in another world. Maybe it's just an internal reality show run off by some hidden cameraman that we don't know about, who makes us experience the objects that we do. And there is no external world. Or maybe there is an external world, and it's what causes these percepts to happen in our mind, but the percepts aren't copies of the real world. The real world is nothing like them. Well, there are all kinds of in-between positions to take. So we'll want to pay special attention to how he thinks it is that we can know for sure that there are bodies, objects in the world outside us. And then finally, there is God. And Locke makes very clear that he thinks, as Descartes did before him, that there is proof of the existence of God. And he's going to give it to you. I'm going to read you his proof today. Well, let's take the first one. Do we know intuitively by introspection that our minds operate in certain ways? It seems to me we do. What we don't know in this way is whether other people have minds. How do we know? And Descartes had raised the problem this way. Descartes says, how do we know those aren't cleverly constructed robots that are walking around and talking to us, and they don't have minds? How do we know they have minds? And of course, that's a more pressing issue today when we have robots that do amazing things and have artificial intelligence built into them and so on. It's almost eerie that Descartes uses that example before 1650. But it occurred to him, and it has to occur to Locke. Locke had to have read Descartes. We know that. So what does he say about this intuition? Well, we're aware of our own self. And then we see other beings around us that look like us, act like us, respond. We can enter into conversations. And all of that assumes that they do have minds. It's the next thinker that we're going to tackle, George Berkeley, who argues this at length. And it was given a very thorough analysis in a book called God and Other Minds, written by a friend of mine, Alvin Plantinga. And he showed definitely that none of the arguments anybody had ever given to show that other perceived beings have minds like ours succeed. They don't succeed. The proofs fall short. And yet, we all believe that other people have minds. I think myself that that's one of the things that's self-evident to us in our experience of other people. But we'll return to that more in depth when we deal with George Berkeley, the next thinker on our list. Because Locke doesn't raise the issue. He just says we know there are selves, there are minds, because we introspect and we intuitively know our own mind. When it comes to how do we know perceptions correspond to real physical bodies outside of our minds, you will be surprised, I think, and maybe disappointed, I hope, to hear that what he has to say about that is only this. Some people may pretend to doubt there are any real objects, but I doubt they're sincere. The perceptions we have are so realistic and fit together so well that it seems to be that we're having percepts of a real organized world outside ourselves. Of course, those objects outside, he adds, don't have color, don't make sounds, don't have tastes and smells and tactile feels to them. All that stuff's only in our minds, but the objects out there occupy space, they move, they exert forces, they cause effects. They have mass and weight and solidity and so on. And that's just repeating what Galileo's hypothesis was. Galileo put forward the theory, the guess, that the things outside of our minds are purely physical, and what's inside our minds are purely sensory copies of the external objects. And I think that I already pointed out to you that if what's inside our minds has only sensory properties, or sensory plus logical, and what's outside of our minds has only physical properties, then what's inside can't be a copy of what's outside. They don't share any property in common. And George Berkeley's going to make a big deal out of that one. And he's going to say, even God couldn't make the ideas, the percepts in our mind, to be copies of external objects. If external objects are purely physical and the perceptions are purely sensory, if that's true, one can't be a copy of the other. They don't even have any property in common. And even God couldn't do that, because miracles are God doing things that we can't duplicate, but which don't violate the law of non-contradiction. It seems to me an apt observation. And most of even Locke's admirers who think that he got us back on the right track as compared with the continental rationalists have to admit that he didn't bring this one off. How do we know that the percepts represent real physical objects? Descartes at least gave a proof. Remember, he argued that normal sense perception is reliable because God couldn't deceive us. He didn't go into how it's possible that something purely physical can be known by something else that's purely sensory. He didn't bring that up, but he did argue that God, because he's all good, had to be maximally honest. He has every perfection. In that case, he can't be deceiving all the people in the world into thinking there's a world when there is none, or that it's utterly unlike what they perceive. But this mistake gets even closer scrutiny then, because of Locke's naivete here. Well, people can say they tell, but I don't think anybody's really sincere. We all believe in there's the world there as we perceive it. Well, that's no argument. That's no philosophical argument. Maybe believing that there's an external world is something like believing that bigger objects fall to the ground faster. Ask any child to put two things in front of them and ask a child which one will fall to the ground faster, they'll pick the heavier one. And that's just a natural mistake that people make. Galileo proves that there was no difference, that the lighter object, the heavier object, fall to the ground at the same rate because they're so close to the mass of the Earth, and it's so huge in comparison to these two things that the heavier one may fall at a slightly faster rate, but it's so minuscule we can't even measure it. Depends how far the thing falls. And in his day, making experiments about this meant going up into a mountain or into a tall building, and tall building wasn't then what it is now. We have buildings in planning that are supposed to be a mile high. I think I'll just be an observer from outside for them, but anyway, they're in the planning. Then the third thing that Locke says we can know for sure is the existence of God. And he has a proof of it, and I'm going to read it to you, because it's important that you get his own words and his own process of thought here. Here, for a moment, is the summary of what we've done so far. All we know is inside our minds. Those are ideas. Ideas come in two flavors. There are percepts and concepts. We know the real existence of three kinds of things, where real means external to the mind. And those three things are selves, bodies, and God. And bodies, selves we know intuitively by introspection, bodies we know by perception, and people can say that they doubt their perceptions reveal to them a real world, but he says none of them really mean it. Nobody's serious about that. And I would say that's because normal sense perception is another kind of self-evident truth. And why didn't Locke want to say that? Because Aristotle and Descartes had placed restrictions on self-evidence that meant that normal sense perception couldn't be self-evident. It had to be something everybody agrees on, and it had to be a law. And then it had to be infallible knowledge. And when I look around the room and I see the objects, those books that are over this shoulder, for example, I think it's self-evident that they're really there. But even self-evidence isn't infallible. I don't think anything we know infallibly. That we have some faculty that cannot possibly make a mistake. I mentioned the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible, and them wanting infallible knowledge. The temptation that they are presented with in that story isn't just about dietary concerns. It's not about this piece of fruit. What they're tempted with is the devil's proposal that if you eat this, then you'll know things the way God does. You'll have infallible knowledge too. And so it says, when Eve saw that the fruit looked good and desirable to eat, and that it could yield real knowledge, she ate it. What's at stake there is infallible knowledge. And that's what our ancestors were tempted with and violated God's law and God's covenant to them, because they wanted to know things as God does. I think we leave infallibility to God. All right, let's see what it is that Locke wants us to know about the proof of the existence of God. Man knows by an intuitive certainty that a bare nothing cannot produce real being any more than two equal right angles can be exceeded in a triangle. Therefore, if we know there is some real being and that non-entity can't produce any real being, that's an evident demonstration that from eternity there has been something. I think there's a better way to put that, and that Locke has a real point up to this juncture. Consider the sum total of reality. The sum total of all that's real would have to be self-existent in part or whole, because there's nothing else for it to depend on. And there are religious traditions that say the part that's self-existent, the divine, is the wholeness. Those traditions are Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism. It's the beingness of Brahmanatman, out of which Brahmanatman generates this world in which we live, and all these things look finite and temporary, and that's why they're Maya, illusion, because they're actually all made of Brahmanatman, and they are made of the eternal, self-existent, divine being. And according to those traditions, then, standing in the right relation to the divine means pursuing those mystical practices that will help ensure that when we die, we are not born again into another lifetime of suffering, but absorbed into Brahmanatman as a drop of water is absorbed into the sea. There are three major religions that say it's not the wholeness. It's one being, God, who has brought into existence everything else. So there's a real world of finite things, not made out of the being of God, but called into existence by God. Now we are part of that world, and standing in proper relation to God is what gets us the promise of everlasting life, that though we all die, we will all be raised again from the dead and live forever in God's kingdom. Those three religions are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So I think Locke's on to something at first. Since there are things that exist now, and none of them appears to be eternal, there had to be something in existence in the past. Now, Locke then jumps to something that he's not entitled to. He's going to tell you that that something must be eternal. It must have always existed, because something can't come into being from nothing. All right, but that doesn't show it always existed. And it can be, as a lot of people are saying today, that's exactly what did happen. There was nothing, and then the universe just sort of popped into existence, and we don't know why, but we don't think there's a creator. It's the universe that's self-existent, in part or whole. So we have three ways of construing this dependency. Pantheism, which says there is an eternal divine being, which we cannot conceive of, and it has generated out of itself made creaturely world out of itself. Creatures come into being and pass away. Brahmanatman doesn't. Creatures are limited. Creatures have color, size, shape. They move around, and so on. Brahmanatman doesn't. But since all the creatures in the creaturely world that we experience are made of Brahmanatman, they humans, the conscious beings, the beings who can be either good or evil, can, if they are good, be reabsorbed into Brahmanatman and escape the cycle, the inevitable wheel of rebirth, and avoid being reborn into another lifetime of suffering. On the other side, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all insist there is only one being that's self-existent, and all, everything else depends on that being, and that is God, the Creator and Redeemer. Those three religions not only hold that God is eternal, that is, independent of time, that He created the universe, and a created feature of the created universe is to be temporal, to be in time and space. But God is also Redeemer. He cares about people. In fact, He visits and redeems His people. Christianity takes that quite literally. God incarnated Himself into a human being and came into the world to rescue humans from sin and punishment. In all three religions, the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead is to be found. It originated in Judaism, is endorsed entirely by Christianity and by Islam. There's a day of the Lord when God calls history to a close and all people are judged by Him and so on. That's how it occurs in all three. Not all branches of Judaism hold that, but there's the Orthodox still do, and some of the conservative branches of Judaism do. So let's go on with our reading. I didn't mean to have such an extended interruption. From eternity, there must have been something, since nothing can come into being out of nothing. That was an old saying in the ancient world, too. It's in Latin. Ex nihilo nihil fit. Out of nothing comes nothing. So from eternity, there's been something, since everything that's not eternal has a beginning, and what had a beginning had to be produced by something else. So there's some self-existent reality. And that eternal being must be most powerful. It's evident that what had its being and its beginning from something else must also have everything which is true of it and belongs to it from something else. All the powers it has must be owing to and received from the source that generates its existence, the same source, he says. This eternal source, then, of all being must also be the source of all power. So this eternal being must also be the most powerful. A lot of people today would not follow that argument. They would not find that convincing. Maybe there is something self-existent, because the sum total of reality has to be self-existent in part or whole. But they could argue that it's a part that generates everything else, and that part is the natural world. It's the natural world. It's space and time and quantum gravity, stuff like that. And that given that the universe develops out of that, everything else takes place by processes that are perfectly natural and don't need to have been thought of and brought about by deliberation by some self-existent being that is also personal and supreme in knowledge as well as power. Not Locke tries to get that in here, but he really just says it. And today there are much more plausible ways of denying that than existed in his day. But that's what he wants to argue. It's most powerful and most knowing. Again, man finds in himself perception and knowledge. We have then to go one step further. We certainly know now that there is not only some being, but some knowing, intelligent being in existence. Either there was a time then when there was no knowing being, and when knowledge began to be, or else there's been knowing from eternity. If it's said that there is a time when there was no being that had knowledge, and when that eternal being was void of all understanding, I reply that then it was impossible that it should ever have been, and there should ever have been any knowledge. It's impossible that things wholly void of knowledge and operating blindly and without any perception should produce a knowing being. It's impossible that a triangle should make its three interior angles bigger than it is. They are. Well, so what he's saying is that what's envisioned by what we call in philosophy naturalists, that means people that believe it's some part of or the whole of the natural world that is the divine being. That's just not possible. Because if you have, say, just space and quantum gravity and maybe a little bit of matter someplace, and all these things interact so as to start producing stars and galaxies, and from there you get life evolve and so on. Well, that whole picture Locke just dismisses and says, well, that's impossible. Well, why would it have to be impossible? I mean, that's what needs to be shown. Show us that that's impossible. Well, he just says it. That's not a good argument. Okay, he goes on. Therefore, God, from the consideration of ourselves and what we infallibly find in our own constitutions, our reason leads us to the knowledge of this certain and evident truth that there is an eternal, most powerful, and most knowing being. Whether you call it God or something else matters not. The thing is evident, and from this idea, duly considered, will easily be deduced from about these attributes, which we ought to describe to this eternal being. Notice what Locke doesn't try to do. He doesn't even attempt to show that this being is good rather than evil. He doesn't attempt to show that this being cares about human beings rather than doesn't care at all or takes a glee in seeing them destroy themselves. Nothing beyond there has to be something that was a cause of other things. The other things that we perceive in the world around us all come into being and pass away. So there had to be something that doesn't do that. And I gave a slightly different argument that I think is correct. If you take the sum total of reality, it has to, in part or whole, be self-existent because there's nothing else for it to depend on. But in my opinion, that doesn't show whether the self-existent being is good, evil, knowledgeable, totally ignorant, a natural force, or Brahmanatman. It doesn't show anything. And it certainly doesn't show that it is the Judeo-Christian Muslim idea of God. Creator who created man deliberately, whether by evolution or how, and it is interested in fact loves the human race and wants to rescue it and have the human race persist for all eternity in his kingdom. Nothing like that. And remember, it's according to our New Testament, we love him because he first loved us. Right? It does no good to find there's a self-existent something which started the ball rolling somehow and generated the world that we now know. If that something is incapable of caring about us, or is capable but doesn't, why would we be interested? No, I think the New Testament's right. We love him, we care about him, because he first loved us. There's something to be lost by rejecting God. All the things he promises to those who don't, who acknowledge him and his power and are thankful to him and try to live their lives in conformity to his will. Right? So I think that this gets going right near something that can be put as a valid argument, but then he thinks he gets much more out of it than he really gets. So when we look at this summary of him again that I had on the board for you, I'm still calling this a blackboard. It's not God whose existence can be proven. It's that something is self, and the backward E means existence. Something self-existent, but that's as far as we can get. We can't infer that something is God as revealed in Scripture. That's the summary of this talk, and the main focus has been Locke's proof of God. Sorry, Charlie, but it doesn't work. And you remember I suggested to you before that it should not be surprising to us that none of these attempts to prove God's existence work, because according to Scripture, God created everything, visible or invisible. God created the laws that govern his creation as well as the things that are governed by them. So he created the laws of math and logic. Then we should not expect that he is subject to them, that the logical laws apply to him such that we can infer his existence from, I don't know what, other premises, perceptions, ideas. No. God's beyond proof for the reason that he is the creator of the laws of proof. Therefore, they don't apply to him. And when we try to apply them anyway, we may do so for good reason. We want to show other people this wonderful truth that we have found. But we do it by demeaning God, lowering God from the creator of everything true of and found in the cosmos, to being another creature to whom the laws of the cosmos apply. Sometimes people have said to me, that is a wild and extreme position, and don't you realize it means that God can violate the law of non-contradiction? So God can bring it about that there are five-sided triangles, and that 1 and 1 equals 8.5. And he could also bring it about that he is infinitely wise while totally ignorant. No, it doesn't. Saying that God created the laws doesn't mean that the laws don't hold for his creation. They do. All creatures are subject to those laws because they're real laws of the reality, the real creation that God has brought into existence. But saying that they don't turn around and apply to God means they don't apply to God. Not that he can break them. God can't break those laws because they don't even apply to him. We can't break them because they do apply to us. And there's nothing nonsensical about that. Well, we're going to leave that topic and introduce a new one. And we only have time to, in today's lesson, to introduce the new one. This has to do with winding up Locke's theory. It has to do with where he comes out, where he wants to come out. And those aren't always the same things. Locke wants to reaffirm what was proposed by Galileo and taken up by Descartes, that the external world around us is purely physical. So that things in the world, the objects that we perceive, don't have color, for example. They're purely physical. They have only physical properties. I was taught this in junior high as part of the science course. And here's the way the theory goes. There are objects around us that we perceive, but those objects don't have color. What they have is a certain irregularity on their surface, so that when light shines on that surface, the surface absorbs all the different wavelengths of light except the one that we perceive as brown. And that wavelength is reflected, hits our eye, affects our retina, goes to the occipital lobe of our brain, and we perceive brown. But the brown is in here. The external object's only physical. That's not science. That's a philosophical theory. It's a theory of materialism. There's just as good an account of the external world that says that the external world not only has properties such as weight, mass, density, solidity, and so on, the physical properties, it also has the property of appearing brown in normal light to normal perception. And that's a real property of the object too. It may be, of course, that wavelengths of light are involved in all sorts of other things, but that doesn't mean that the object fails to have the disposition to appear brown in normal light to normal perception. And if it does, it has then a sensory property also. Just as it also, and I said passively before, it also passively has properties that are biotic, properties that are social, linguistic. It has the property of being able to be referred to. And it has a multiplicity of kinds of properties, some of which are passive in relation to human capabilities, so that what the object possesses the disposition to exhibit those properties in relation to us. I won't go into that further, but that's been worked out in impressive detail by Professor Herman Dooyeweerd of the Free University of Amsterdam. An entire theory of reality that takes all the kinds of properties and laws that appear to us to be true of the world around us by normal perception and argues that they are all real. And that that's an even better ontology than the theories of reality that try to say the external world has only physical properties, or the external world itself is nothing but sense perceptions, or the external world is nothing but physical properties plus logical ones, or physical plus mathematical. I'm going through that kind of list because all of those have really been theories that people have presented in Western philosophy and more. There's been a parade of things to plug in to their theory to count as substance, what it is that produces everything else. And I argued before, that is really only God, if we're to be really, I think, theists, Jews, Christians, or Muslims. When it comes to doing philosophy, we should rid ourselves of the idea of substance. There's nothing in the universe that everything else in the universe depends on, about which we should say, and that in turn depends on God. It's God that hangs all things together, in addition to calling them into existence and sustaining them in existence. Enough. I don't want to repeat everything that I've done in the course on Christian philosophy, but for those of you who have had it, I remind you how to apply that stuff here. And for those of you who haven't had it, I urge you to get it. Take that course too. You'll be able to contrast the approach to reality, theory of reality, and theory of knowledge from the point of view that God generates everything other than himself, including the laws of logic and mathematics we call necessary truths, that they are necessary for creatures, not for the creator who brought them into existence. So I think we are pretty much done with Mr. Locke. He certainly has direct, except for his political theory, that we haven't gotten to, and that I've started to say we have finished everything, and we've come to the juncture now where we will cover the last thing that I intend to cover, and that's his theory of the state. And let me explain that that term causes some confusion in the U.S., because in the U.S. we use state to mean a subdivision of the country. But everywhere else and before that, state meant the government. And if there was a central government and outlying governments, subsidiary governments, they were all parts of the state. That's the name for the political institution of society, the institution that makes an order of public justice, creates a legal order, and then provides a way to enforce that by having police and courts. And the courts also interpret the law, so when people have a dispute as to how to interpret it, they come before the court and the court resolves it. That's the idea that is universal about a state as a public institution. It wasn't always a public institution. In the ancient world, there were a lot of states that were no such thing, and therefore weren't really states in our modern sense of the word. Ancient Egypt, for example. The theory in ancient Egypt was that the land of Egypt and all upon it, including all humans, were the property of the pharaoh. There's nothing public about this. It's private. It's his private property. All citizens, well, all of the people we would like to think of as citizens were his slaves. And all the land belonged to him and everything in it, all the minerals, the water, and so forth, they all belonged to Pharaoh. So there was no public political institution. Contrast that with what happened in ancient Greece. There were cities that arose, and then they began to pass laws and set up ways to adjudicate them and so on, and states came into being, and they viewed them as public institutions. That is, the entire public is ruled by the laws the state makes and enforces, and the entire state has some input into the laws and how they're phrased and enacted into law. So we get real states in the modern sense at a certain point in history that is not all that long ago. Maybe 25, 26, 700 years there have been states. And even when there began to be, there were still other, I'll call them nations, that were not states, where everything in that nation and everyone who lived in it was considered the private property of the ruler. But we are interested in Locke's theory of the state. Locke comes along well after states have become the usual way for nations to organize themselves internally. And Locke begins in the same way his countryman Thomas Hobbes began, and namely by talking about humans without a state in what they call, they both call, the state of nature. So there's going to be the state of nature, and there's going to be the political state. There's going to be humans as they originally began to be on this planet. They have a theory about that, as opposed to humans having created a state or having come to live in states that are political institutions that make and enforce laws. So Locke starts with the state of nature, and he does not want to reaffirm what his countryman Hobbes earlier said. Remember that for Hobbes, the state of nature of humans was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. That's often quoted because it's such a wonderful phrase, it's hard to forget it once you hear it. But notice the first thing the state of nature is for Hobbes is solitary. There are only single individuals attempting to survive. And the only right they have are natural rights, not legal rights. The natural right to preserve your life. That's the only sense that the term right can have in this state of nature, according to Hobbes. And morality and a legal order are things that humans band together and invent because of the inconveniences of living in a state that's solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Locke doesn't want to go along with that. He doesn't want to say morality and a legal code are sheer inventions of humans, that nothing is really right or wrong. We just decide what to put in those categories and make the rules. That's what Hobbes said. That's not Locke. For Locke, the state of nature may be solitary, but it already includes solitary, but people know ethical truths. And these ethical truths he's already argued for. So he thinks everybody has a natural kind of intuitive knowledge that murder is wrong, that stealing is wrong, that lying to somebody else is wrong. And notice those things are not only ethically wrong, they're wrong from the standpoint of being loving to our fellow human beings, but they are also legally wrong. So they enter into the legal code and are enforced by law. You kill somebody else, the cops come for you. Steal somebody's goods, the cops come for you. You lie, sometimes the cops come for you. I mean by that, a lie can be something that doesn't enter into the public realm of discourse, but it's private between two people. I lied to you about where I was on Saturday afternoon. That doesn't have any result for the general public. But if I lie and misrepresent, say, how much my house is worth in order to pledge it against a loan, now I'm entered into the public banking sphere of life, and there are laws that govern that and say you can't lie on it. You lie on this document, there are going to be penalties, and they may be a trip to the Gray Bar Motel. You make some time, spend some time in lockup, or at the very least get a severe fine. Okay, Locke thinks all of that comes with the natural state of humans. So there are natural rights that people have, and there are natural right and wrong things that they have, they know. And natural rights are going to be such things as, I have the right not to be lied to, I have the right not to be robbed, I have the right not to be assaulted. It's the flip side of what we know to be ethical truths. It's wrong to murder, then I have the right not to be murdered. It's wrong to lie, it's wrong to steal, I have the right to be free of the theft of my goods and the assault, any assault on my person. And it's wrong to lie, then it's going to be a crime to lie to me in public realm. So that's how I see and Christian view of what the state is. The institution of society that has as its duty the establishment of a public legal order and the responsibility to enforce it. And since the state has the responsibility of enforcement, it has the power, it controls all military power as well. And that makes it the institution chiefly tasked with protecting the state from foreign invasion. I think that's probably a better rounded view than Locke's going to give us, but I take that to be a Christian view. And we'll close on this note and finish Locke's political theory when we meet again. I look forward to it.